Just know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place your home.
Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is October 30th, 2013, and the title of today's podcast is Home, Discharging Patients with Pulmonary Embolism from the Emergency Department. I hope all the SGEM listeners had a happy Halloween. If you have not checked out the talented Beam Scream team, head over to my YouTube channel and watch us sing I Will Survive. Today on the SGEM, we have two guest skeptics. Dr. Chris Carpenter, and you should be familiar with him, he's part of the Beam Dream team. He wrote the EBM book, literally, called Diagnostic Testing and Clinical Decision Rules. Oops, I mean tools. Welcome back to the show, Chris.
Thanks, Ken. It's great to be back, and I'm really excited about today's topic.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you, because it's always great to have you, but we have another guest skeptic today, and it's a hematologist, Dr. Alex Lazelanger from Western University in London, Ontario. Please say hello to the SGEM audience, Alex.
Hello, Ken. Thanks for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, like I said, it was exciting because I've got, you know, an emergency medicine EBM specialist, but you bring to the show some extra credentials as an assistant professor in biostatistics and epidemiology, as well as the Department of Medicine Division of Hematology. And I just love the fact that you're a hematologist. One of the first things I teach emergency medicine residents is don't panic. All bleeding stops eventually. Now I actually have an expert to confirm this fact. Alex, do people bleed forever?
Yeah, certainly they do not. It depends on how fast can you plug the finger in the hole.
A nice little Dutch reference there, yes. Well, today we're going to be talking about discharging pulmonary embolism patients directly home from the emergency department. And this topic came up because Chris Carpenter's great journal club, and Chris, you have a great journal club out of Washington University.
And thanks, Ken.
You're welcome. And last month, you tackled outpatient management of acute PEs, among other things. And you sent it along to me. And what was it that I said back to you when you said you were admitting more than 90% of your PE patients?
Yeah, you said that you can't remember the last time you admitted one. And I said, I can't do an expletive on this, so I'm not going to swear, but I didn't believe you. And the dichotomy of opinions, my colleagues thought I was crazy for doing this topic because they don't want to send any of these patients home. And you thought we were crazy for doing it because you don't admit any of them. And it just flabbergasted me that there's such a huge discrepancy in care in these patients. And you want to know what the right answer is.
Yeah, it blew my mind too. I was like, whoa, I mean, I don't think we admit, you know, 90% of our patients like you have been. That hasn't been my experience, but I thought, well, maybe it's just my experience. So Alex, I mean, you're an experienced guy at a large Canadian academic center. Are you admitting more than 90% of your PE patients?
Certainly not. No, we probably admit only about half of our patients. This is not only our experience, it's that also from our centers, in particular Ottawa and Hamilton, do exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Well, Chris, with your permission, I'm going to use the same case scenario you used for your journal club, because having a case to set it up will assist us in going through this podcast and critically appraising the systematic review that you picked out.
So, yeah, that's fine. This is an actual case that came into the emergency department that prompted this journal club.
So let's go here. We've got a healthy 19-year-old undergraduate student who presents with chest pain and shortness of breath. Her blood pressure is 120 over 80, her heart rate is 60, respiratory rate is 16, O2 sat is 100% on room air, and her temperature is 37.1 degrees Celsius. She is Wells low, but she is PERC positive for being on the birth control pill. The D-dimer comes back and it's like, oh, it's elevated. And we always, always are hoping for that negative D-dimer. Yep. So you send her off for a CT scan and it shows a peripheral pulmonary embolism. So the question is, can she be safely discharged home with outpatient management? And some background on PE, well, we all know it's a common medical problem that gets diagnosed in the emergency department. Alex, do you ever get called about PEs in the emerge?
Only when they don't want to keep them there for any longer.
So you get called because they want to admit them.
Yeah, exactly. They usually don't. I mean, the emergency physicians are pretty good at that, and most of them won't admit patients unless there's a very good reason to admit them.
So in other words, being on call for hematology, you don't get called that often for PE patients because the vast majority of them are being sent home.
Exactly.
Chris, you looked at this from an epidemiology perspective at your journal club, but also with the framework of overdiagnosis. Can you tell us about a little of these two issues before we proceed?
Yeah, I think that the concept of overdiagnosis and overtreatment are closely interlinked. I was at Dartmouth's first ever preventing overdiagnosis conference in early September this year, and actually the prototypical disease process for emergency medicine of overdiagnosis was the diagnosis of pulmonary embolism CT. If you open up our leading textbook, Rosen's textbook of emergency medicine, approximately one in every 500 to 1,000 ED patients, that's 0.1 to 0.2%, will have a pulmonary embolism when tested. Pundits increasingly suggest that contemporary CTs may too accurately diagnose PEs. Hard to believe that we actually have a test that's too accurate, but in the case of pulmonary embolism, I think we're there. That means that clinically insignificant PEs are being detected by modern scanners. That is a PE that was not the cause of the patient's symptoms, and it's not destined to cause the patient to die or to have permanent disability. In support of this observation, there is a significant temporal trend of increased PEs diagnosed across the world since CTs became readily available in 1998. If clinically significant PEs were truly becoming more common since 1998, as opposed to overdiagnosis of clinically inconsequential PEs, then PE-related mortality should be increasing. But that's not the trend. It's stable over the last 40 years. And that meets the criteria of overdiagnosis. And I can point you towards multiple publications that describe this concept in more detail.
Alex, do you think that these new CT scanners and the availability of all these CT scanners, do you think we're picking up more PEs that are inconsequential?
We are certainly doing so. And there's also evidence from randomized trials. About 4 or 5 years ago, there was the PETS trial published in JAMA by Dave Anderson and our group. And it's basically randomized patients to pulmonary emboli or ventilation perfusion scans. And what it found is that the patients who were randomized to a CT scan arm had about 5% more PEs detected than the ventilation perfusion scan. But there was no difference in the mortality or recurrence rates. And this is basically associated with multi-slice scanners, usually, in particular the ones that are 64 slices or higher.
So the more slices we have, the more PEs we're picking up. And we all took an oath, right, Chris, Alex, myself? We all took an oath to first do no harm. So by picking up all these things, Chris, are we actually putting patients at risk? Are we harming them by picking up all these PEs, or at least trying to diagnose 100%?
Yeah, I think we are. The best laid intentions, but we're harming patients inadvertently. David Newman, your friend and mine, estimates that in the pulmonary embolism rule-out criteria study, testing for PE prevented 6 deaths and 24 major non-fatal PE events, while causing 36 deaths and 37 non-fatal major medical harms like renal failure, major hemorrhage, and cancer. Overtesting is inextricably linked to overdiagnosis, and in the case of pulmonary embolism, increased testing leads to increased harm. And the harms extend beyond the iatrogenic injury. In the United States, your insurance premiums are directly tied to the diagnosis you carry. If you're diagnosed with pulmonary embolism as a patient, you're going to carry that diagnosis the rest of your life, and you're going to pay more for insurance.
But don't you all have Obamacare now?
Oh, not yet. We've got this Canadian web developer who's fallen down on the job, not developed a website for us. Damn Canadians.
That'll come up in another podcast, I'm sure. Chris, why do you think there's such a problem with overtesting for PEs in the U.S.?
Well, in my mind, and I've thought a lot about this since the Journal Club and since learning how well you handle this in Canada, I think there's a lot of issues. There's layers of issues that we need to deal with in the United States. We've got an unfriendly malpractice environment. We've got distrust by patients and clinicians of existing non-imaging clinical decision aids like the Wells criteria and the PERC criteria that you mentioned. We've got a patient and family belief in the United States that more testing equates to better care. We've got reimbursement streams that reward more testing or fail to reward less testing. And we've got a physician perception that all PEs are potentially lethal and therefore merit inpatient monitoring. That's certainly what I was taught in medical school. And I think that erroneous teaching continues. And I think you got to peel back the layers of each of these problems to get to the solution in the United States.
So what are you going to do about this over-testing problem? What can you do about this over-testing problem, Chris?
Well, I think the first line of defense against pulmonary embolism overdiagnosis is to use evidence-based diagnostics to guide which patients to evaluate with D-dimer and advanced imaging, namely use Wells criteria and PERT criteria.
Currently, you discharge 1% of your PE patients, but you're asked by your admitting service to discharge about 21% more of those cases. The situation, like we alluded to earlier, is different in Canada. Papers started coming out in the early 2000s demonstrating the safety of outpatient management of PEs, and a pragmatic evaluation of the ambulatory management of PEs came out in 2008. And in fact, we have that author, Alex, on the program right now. And this showed that 50% of patients were being safely treated as outpatients. So Alex, tell us about that paper a bit.
So we did a retrospective cohort of the last 5 years, those 5 years between 2003 and 2004, see how were we doing with this, because we wanted to see whether we were admitting too many patients to the hospital or not, and if they were being admitted, why. So what we basically found is half of the patients were admitted to the hospital and the other half were not. How was assessed the need for an admission to the hospital was basically using clinical gestalt.
So your study had clinical gestalt identifying low-risk patients, and retrospectively, it seemed like a safe strategy. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
All right, and it's not that much of a surprise, because I guess it was already acceptable to manage DVT patients or deep vein thrombosis patients as outpatients, and a third of those have asymptomatic pulmonary embolisms. And you know, another interesting fact is that most deaths from pulmonary embolism occur after the initial short hospital stay. It's not during the hospital stay, those 3, 4, 5 days, that people are dying. Most of the people with PEs die after that first hospital stay. So we have this US-Canada divide with some randomized control trials, some observational trials, and chart reviews on the subject. But let's go to a higher level of EBM evidence. Let's look at a systematic review on the specific topic of ambulatory treatment of acute PEs. Chris, this is your paper, so can you give us the reference?
Well, it's not my paper, but we certainly reviewed this. It's in Annals of Emergency Medicine 2012. The title is, Can Selected Patients with Newly Diagnosed PE Be Safely Treated Without Hospitalization? A Systematic Review.
And so the population that they were looking at was adult patients with confirmed PEs, and the intervention was outpatient management, whereas the control or the comparator was inpatient management, and the outcome was recurrent venothromboembolism, major hemorrhage, and all-cause mortality. So the methods that these guys used were that they searched multiple databases without language restrictions. They also reviewed 4 years of conference proceedings from major EM journals, and they even consulted experts in the field to make sure they weren't missing any relevant research. So they really did a good job. And then they followed the PRISMA. Chris, what's PRISMA stand for again?
It's the preferred reporting items for systematic reviews and meta-analysis, basically the cookbook on how to do a systematic review.
I knew I could go to you with that. And they also used reporting guidelines to assess the quality of the original studies using the grade criteria. And Chris, what are those?
Grading of recommendations, assessment, development, and evaluation. Basically a report card for the quality of the information that goes into guidelines.
For the results, they had 8 studies that they identified to include in it, which had 777 adult patients. One of them was a randomized clinical control trial, and 7 were observational studies. Only 4, or 50%, were actually based in the emergency department, and no patients were lost to follow-up, so good job. 7 studies reported a 90-day outcome measure on 741 patients, and there was 0, yes, 0 thromboembolic or hemorrhage-related deaths. I mean, that's pretty impressive. No deaths whatsoever. And when they looked for non-fatal recurrence of a VTE, or venous thromboembolism, the studies ranged from 0 to 6.2%, so between 0 and 6.2% for non-fatal recurrence of the clot, and then for non-fatal hemorrhages, it ranged from 0 to 1.2%. So the author's conclusion was, quote, the data on exclusive outpatient management of acute symptomatic pulmonary embolism are limited, but the existing evidence supports the feasibility and safety of this approach in carefully selected low-risk patients. So let's get into some discussion here. I mean, it was a really important study asking a really important question. Can some patients with PEs be treated as outpatients? So Chris, what's your take on this paper and what do you see as the limitations?
Well, there are some limitations of the paper. The studies were heterogeneous, both in quality and in the design that they employed to study this question. They're overall poor quality by the grade criteria that the authors used. They're poor primarily because they're observational in nature, and the EBM world is replete with studies of observational design that showed benefit multiple times, and then a subsequent RCT showed no benefit. An example, lung reduction surgery for emphysema. They also failed to assess publication bias. They had no assessment of how many urban ED patients in the US would be eligible for this protocol. And that's a big issue because we don't yet have Obamacare. Not everybody has a primary care physician, and their access to these anticoagulation therapies is a real question in our patients. Urban patients in St. Louis, 50% have no insurance whatsoever, no access to medications. And once they leave the hospital walls, they may not get any medication. And the standard of care is anticoagulation for several months after the diagnosis of PE. And I put as a limitation that only one study used the PESI criteria to risk stratify patients. I think that's debatable, though. I think that there is good evidence that Alec has made me aware of that Gestalt is probably equal to PESI scores or the HESTIA criteria or other measures of PE risk.
Well, you brought up the PESI score, so let's get into it. The Pulmonary Embolism Severity Index. That was the preferred risk stratification tool that you used for your Washington University protocol, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Alex, you're familiar with the PESI score?
I am.
What thoughts do you have about using it as a risk stratification score?
Well, the pros about this score is basically that it's one that has been validated in a larger number of studies. But the problem with the PESI score, so it has a bunch of different items. To start with, we say there are two PESI scores, the original score, which is a little bit more complicated, and there's another one which is simplified that has less items. But some of the items that the PESI score, and especially, and both of the versions, simplified and the other and the original PESI score have, one in particular of them is the presence of cancer. And this is the focus of a lot of criticism of these two scores, because the presence of cancer pretty much converts almost every single patient in a high risk patient. I mean, these scores help people who is not totally comfortable treating or assessing these patients to make a better informed choice. So I think that's the real value of all of these scores.
So, Alex, you brought up the fact that there were sort of two PESI scores. One is the original one, and it had 11 items. And you know what? 11 is my second favorite number, but it had 11 items, and that was a lot to remember. And each item gets a different score. So some items give you 10 points, some give you 20, 30, all the way up to 60 points. And those items I'll put in the blog. But they came up with a simplified score, which I like better because it only had six items, which is closer to my favorite number of five. The six items, again, like you said, included cancer. And if you're risk stratifying patients from a class 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, so they had five classes of risk stratification in the PESI score, the low risk one had a score of less than 65, which gave you a 30-day PE-related mortality of 0 to 1.6%. But in the example you gave, you have a 50-year-old person, you get 1 point for every year of age. So you've got 50 points already, and you throw on history of cancer, and cancer has 30 points. Already you're at 80 points. That puts you at a class 2 level of 1.7 to 3.5% risk score. So right away you can see that that cancer thing does elevate it. You suggested a different scoring system that may be used called HESTIA score out of the Netherlands. Could you explain that to us, Alex?
Yeah, the HESTIA basically it's a more practical more thing. There's been a bunch of scores. So just don't misunderstand. It's not only the ones that we're discussing here are not the only ones. But the point of all of these scores to be practical for use in emergency medicine setting, they have to be readily available. All the components of them have to be readily available. So you have to have an echocardiogram or a bainatritic peptide assessment. It's not helpful. So the Hestia criteria basically tried to use criteria that basically are clinical gestalt, such as the presence of hemodynamic instability, the need, the presence of active or high risk for bleeding, the need for oxygen. So it's basically the same things that we use in routine practice in clinical gestalt to determine whether a patient needs to be admitted to the hospital or not. The objective of this study was trying to make it much more user-friendly. And there's been a number of studies and a recent study that was also published comparing Hestia versus the PESI score. And actually what is very interesting of that study is that the Hestia study was able to identify a proportion of patients who were initially classified as high risk using the simplified PESI score, but who were actually safely treated at home without any real risk of recurrence. So I think this is an ongoing issue. It's evolving right now. We really don't know what's the best score to use. Personal perspective, I think the ones that are based on simple clinical, logical clinical variables are probably the way to go. And if I were to use one of those, I would probably incline myself for the Hestia criteria. But again, it also has some caveats, but it's basically the same thing of basically who needs to be admitted. Well, the guys who are really sick are the ones who need to be admitted to the hospital. That's a question.
Alex, I was going to say, have you met many emergency doctors? I mean, our audience is mainly emergency physicians, and we like simple. We like simple. We've got short attention spans. So, you know, a short clinical decision rule or instrument or tool, as I like to call them, is better. Chris, you had some final thoughts on the clinical application because you put together a protocol, which again, I will post on the blog with your permission. You had a clinical application for how we're going to take all this information in and use it?
So yeah, Ken, my thought is that using this protocol that we put together in conjunction with our hospitalist and our emergency medicine staff, we'd have a pathway to follow for patients to, number one, identify low-risk patients. And we advocated using the PESI tool, although that is debatable, I agree. But also so that our hospitalist service, who we admit to when we do need to admit these patients, recognize what the psychosocial parameters are that we need to work around to make sure that every patient, regardless of their insurance status, regardless of their ability to pay, and regardless of their ability to get follow-up once they leave the hospital, gets the appropriate treatment for their venous thromboembolism. And so in our consensus was that in select and agreeable non-geriatric adult patients, non-geriatric because we felt that many of these studies really didn't have a very good sampling of geriatric patients over the age of 65, that in those non-geriatric adult patients with newly diagnosed pulmonary embolism, transportation access to outpatient anticoagulation care and a reliable caregiver at home, that outpatient management of PE is safe with a PE or hemorrhage-related death rate of far less than 1%. And I think your Canadian data certainly backs that up.
Yeah, I think it does. And we are really in an exciting time right now. I mean, Alex alluded to the fact that there's all these different clinical decision instruments being worked upon and trying to find a really good one that can help us determine who's high risk, who's low risk, and who best could be treated as an inpatient and who best to be treated as an outpatient. And one of the wrinkles is, Alex, we've got a lot of these new oral anticoagulants. Do you have any sort of thoughts, any sort of clairvoyance on where you think the role or where do you think that's going to go in PE management?
Well, it certainly is gaining a lot of momentum, in particular in the States where they've recently been approved to treat pulmonary emboli. I mean, in Canada, as it stands today, they are actually not like one of the new ones, rivaroxaban was the only one that's been approved to treat deep vein thrombosis. It's not yet approved to treat pulmonary emboli, although that should be coming very soon. But I think it's not going to really change anything. I mean, unless we really have phase four data in a few years showing that these new drugs do not fare as well as warfarin in terms of long-term management, we shouldn't really see much of a difference. And actually, the use of these new drugs that do not require initial low molecular weight heparin has certainly simplified the management of these pathologies. Even actually easier to send the patients home on pills rather than to send them on low molecular weight heparin injections.
Well, I can already anticipate a future episode looking at these new oral anticoagulants and the role they'll play in PE management.
I can see a future episode coming up on how to deal with the intracranial hemorrhage patients coming in on these new agents as well. Where you can't give vitamin K, you can't give FFP, and there is no real reversible agent to give.
Oh, it's an exciting time to be in medicine. I put together a bottom line for you, Chris, from a U.S. perspective. And the title of the podcast was almost the Clash's song.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double.
But I didn't go with that theme. So, Chris, what's the USA bottom line when it comes to outpatient management of pulmonary embolism?
Well, I think we've got several barriers to overcome. Implementation science is complicated, and like I said, there's multiple layers of complexity in the U.S. healthcare system. For each individual physician, it's going to depend on your own comfort level with this data and the policies and procedures at your home institution and the level of support that you get from your coagulation services. How readily available are low molecular weight heparin or some of these newer anticoagulation agents going to be for uninsured or underinsured patients? How quickly are they going to be able to get follow-up? How reliable is their home care situation so that there's somebody that can take care of them? And are American physicians going to accurately apply either clinical gestalt or whatever decision aid that we end up choosing as the tool to identify lower PE patients? Are they going to accurately apply that? There's lots of clinical decision rule data out there showing that physicians all over the world can't accurately apply very simple rules.
Well, from a Canadian perspective, the Canadian bottom line was what I picked for the theme, and that song was...
No, you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place your home.
No, you're not alone, I'm gonna discharge the PE home. And that's, you know, in our Canadian medical legal environment, of course, we are going to offer outpatient management to low-risk patients with newly diagnosed acute PEs. Now, I don't know if you came up with a case resolution from your journal club, but for the podcast, I put the case resolution is that we engaged in shared decision-making and that you inform her, the patient, that multiple studies have demonstrated that treating a low-risk PE at home with shots and pills is as safe and effective as treating you with the same medications in the hospital if she has the ability to follow up within 7 to 10 days. As scheduled, and has someone at home to help monitor her care. She decides, based on this, to go with the outpatient treatment.
That's about the same conclusion we came to.
So, the Keener contest, last week's winner was Ben Turner, an emergency medicine pharmacist, and he knew that epinephrine was first used for cardiac arrests in 1906, as reported in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. Chris, you came up with the Keener contest this week.
This week's Keener contest, we want to know how many trials is the use of heparin for pulmonary embolism tested in? Not for venous thromboembolism. There's trials out there for DVT and PE. How many trials are there that looked at pulmonary embolism treated with heparin? If you know the number, then send your answer to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener contest in the subject line. The first one with the correct answer will get sent a very cool SGEM skeptical prize.
And don't forget to sign up for our BEAM conferences, which are coming up in 2014. We're getting ready to head out west to Ski BEAM. We're going to be going to the Hammer in Steel BEAM. And of course, my favorite, to Sweden for Sweet BEAM. Alex, thank you very much for participating. It's nice to have you on the show. And we like to give our honored guests the privilege of giving the SGEM tagline. So could you tell all the listeners what we always say at the end of our podcast?
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. And remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk with everyone next week on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.